For decades, the state of Florida and its 29 electoral votes has been the prize for any presidential candidate. To hear about the state of the race in Florida and much more on this episode of The War Room at American Bridge is Steve Schale, one of Florida's leading Democratic strategists and the executive director of Unite the Country Super PAC, one of the leading pro-Biden super PAC operating in this 2020 election. Welcome back to the War Room at American Bridge podcast. I'm David Brock, co-founder of American Bridge 21st Century. Today, it's a pleasure to be joined by Steve Schale. In 2008 and 2012, he served as the state director and then senior advisor for the Obama-Biden campaign in Florida. During the primary in October 2019, he helped launch Unite the Country, the first pro-Biden super PAC. Steve, thanks for joining us in the War Room. So, again, before we get into the specifics, I just want to get your feeling about how things are going in the election. I'm feeling pretty good, especially given the events of the last week, and I want to talk a little bit about some of the events that have been in the news in the last week. Am I right to feel pretty good or not?
Well, I mean, I think there's no question we'd rather be us than them right now. I mean, I'm a Florida Democrat. I'm a Jacksonville Jaguars fan. I'm kind of primed to be disappointed. I think we all have a lot of PTSD from 2016. But I mean, the fundamentals of the race are you know, where we want them to be. I mean, our pack, we just did a series of polling in the upper Midwestern states, for example. And in every one of those states, Joe Biden's leading. He's above 50%. The number of voters that don't want to vote to reelect Trump is over 50%. And, you know, and so I think, you know, I mean, again, 26 days to go from the time we recorded this. I think we can expect complete unexpected things from Trump now to the end. So we're gonna have to run hard through the tape. But, you know, I mean, it's certainly when it comes to my state, we're in better place in Florida today than Secretary Clinton was 4 years ago, that Barack Obama was 8 years ago or 12 years ago. And so I'd rather be us than them. But I don't think anybody's taking anything for granted.
Right. So on that point about some last minute twist or turn from Trump, do you think was his contracting the virus the October surprise? Do you think there's another one coming? And I know, you know, the nature of surprises is they're surprises, so no one knows. But what do you think we might see in the next 27 days or so?
I mean, at this point, I'm half expecting them to tell us that they created Space Force because we're actually at war with some alien country 7 light years away. I think it's so hard to predict at this point. But I do think you all know this, and a lot of the research that we've done together as American Bridge Unite the Country has shown this, that, I mean, the president's competency on the virus has been horrendous. And voters see that and recognize, even voters that are leaning towards voting for him, you know, give him low marks on the virus. And so I think him not only getting the virus, but him essentially turning the White House into a super spreader event, a hot zone. I mean, these things just draw attention back to the central question. I mean, which is he competent to be president? And I mean, as we all remember, I mean, that was basically his core argument. Besides all the negative on Clinton, his core argument was that he was this businessman who had an immense level of competence. And I think we've always sort of held the view, and I know that you all at Bridge have as well, which is a big part of winning the election is to point out the fact that he's actually incredibly incompetent. And I think this whole him getting the thing that we've spent 7 or 8 months trying to get rid of, that he called a hoax himself. I mean, it has to draw. It has to put the attention back on something he doesn't want to talk about right now.
And how does COVID play or show up in the polling that you're looking at?
Well, again, I think what's interesting is, you know, at least in the data that we've done of late, you're starting to see a closer parallel between his overall approval rating and his approval rating on COVID. You know, I think there was a while there where he was still getting credit for some other things, and he might have a, you know, COVID approval in the low 40s, and his approval in battleground states was in the mid 40s. And I think now you're starting to see those things line up. And I think part of that is a function that, you know, most Americans, certainly in battleground states that we've seen, you know, believe you can't fix the economy, which they give them credit for some reason that I don't totally understand other than this 40 years of branding. You can't fix the economy if you don't fix the healthcare crisis. I mean, I live in a state that is entirely dependent upon other people spending money here. We're dependent upon tourism, primarily. People aren't going to travel to Florida as long as there's a virus like there is today, especially when my state's a hotspot. And so how do we get our economy growing until we deal with this virus issue? And so I think, again, everything that I mean, and again, this is something he's brought upon himself. I mean, they contracted the virus because they don't take this thing seriously.
Yeah, right. Let me just pick up on what you said about the economy, because it's been a source of a little frustration for me reading the numbers where on the economy, that's the closest Trump comes to doing well in these head-to-heads. And yet we're in the middle of this incredible recession. And as you said, in 16, voters who voted for Trump often cite the fact that, or not really a fact, it's kind of a non-fact, that he was a successful businessman. Does the New York Times story on the taxes change that? Is there any way to get it at that brand and chip away at it a little bit, even at this late stage?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that the work that a lot of organizations, not the least of which is our organization and your organization, have done over the last 3 or 4 months has had that impact. So, you know, just to give an example, you know, we did a survey in Pennsylvania back in early June, and we tested, you know, a number of issues and traits, who's more honest and more trustworthy and who's better for America. And one of the questions was who's better, you know, to lead America out of this economic crisis we're in. And what was interesting, back in June, you saw Trump with a 20-point advantage on that in one of the leading battleground states. I mean, the survey we just got back last night had that advantage down to 4 or 5. And I think that a lot of that is, you know, has been, you know, I think that combination of our organizations and the campaign have done a really good job of helping explain what Joe Biden's vision on the economy is. I think some of the work that you all have done in highlighting real people who have been impacted by the economy, by Trump's presidency, you know, has made a difference. And so, I mean, my governing theory on the race for a long time has been if we get that economic question anywhere near a push by Election Day, I mean, he just has no path. You know, I mean, we tested 15 traits comparing the two. And the only thing that he still has an advantage on is the economy. And that advantage is down to very little. And so, you know, and again, I think that really is a testament to, you know, honestly, a lot of the work that we all did together over the summer when the campaign was still getting on its feet.
Yeah. So let's dig into Florida a little bit. You're there and you've already said that Biden's in pretty good shape. But we all have, you know, PTSD from the polls of last cycle. And so, you know, we only have to go on what we have to go on now. But do you think the polls are any more accurate or any better this time around, Florida or otherwise?
Well, I think it's important to actually split Florida from sort of everything else. I mean, what's interesting about the polling in Florida, I mean, you know, we could argue about which of these averages makes more sense or not. But if you take the real clear political average, which, you know, whether it's a good average or not, I don't want to debate. But two things happened in the last election. First of all, Secretary Clinton was only above 50% in a handful of polls the entire cycle in Florida. So while she was like right now, she had an average lead. I think if we went back to day 27 before the election, 26, she had an average lead of like 3.5 points. But there was always more undecided. There was more room to grow for Trump. The other thing is by Election Day, Trump actually had I think it was 0.4 or 0.6% lead in the averages. And so in a lot of ways, like the Florida polling wasn't really that off. I mean, what happened is we all know, we all lived it. I mean, the race moved late and, you know, combination of a lot of things, not the least of which is, you know, James Comey deciding to weigh in with 10 days to go, you know, created that. And there being a lot more space in the undecided gave it, you know, room to grow. But, you know, the averages in Florida, again, weren't really that off. They were kind of like the national average and they were pretty close. Now, I think a lot of these states, you know, where the averages were more off, I think some of that was a function, honestly, if I could take a place like Wisconsin. I mean, you know, there's an immense amount of history of polling in a place like Florida. I mean, it's, you know, it gets pulled the hell out of it for, you know, every presidential cycle for the last, you know, 7 or 8 of them. I think some of the other stuff, frankly, just probably just wasn't the experience level to track it. But, you know, again, I mean, even all things being equal, like, I mean, I think Biden's average lead is about 5 points now. I think that's probably a little optimistic. But again, I mean, I think he's in better shape today than even Secretary Clinton was 4 years ago.
And what, so let's just go back a little bit to your experience. Let's go back to 12. And what went right in 12 that went a little off course in 16? And a lot of people I know were kind of disappointed with some of the marquee races in 18 in Florida as well. So what do we need to do to get that vote back?
Yeah, I mean, so it's interesting. Like, if you look at 12 and 16, I think the media has not done a great job of understanding kind of what happened. You know, so if you think of Florida, you know, and this is oversimplifying, but, you know, there's 10 media markets in Florida. And by and large, the Republican markets are up north, and by and large, the Democratic markets are down south. There's some exceptions. Fort Myers, which is in Southwest Florida, is a Republican market. But, you know, so there are 10 media markets. Four of them always vote Democratic. Four of them always vote Republican. It's interesting. If you take those markets and you look at the margin of victory that both Trump in the Republican markets and Romney in the Republican markets and Obama and Clinton, it was basically an identical election. I think that there were, I think actually Secretary Clinton, I think, is 7,000 votes better in the margin in her markets than Trump. I mean, it was, but otherwise it was essentially 55% of the state looked exactly like it did 4 years earlier. The big difference was on the I-4 corridor, you know, and, you know, the Tampa and Orlando media market, about 45% of the state, you know, and what you saw is you saw places, and it wasn't even sort of urban communities. Like, Secretary Clinton actually did much better in, say, Orlando, which has got this rapidly growing Puerto Rican population, than Barack Obama did 4 years or 8 years before that. But these sort of collar counties, these communities that aren't really suburban, they aren't really rural. They're these ex-urban in nature, but they're big, you know, where the race just went sideways. And I mean, a great example of two great examples. I remember on election night talking to our mutual friend, Paul Begala, and it was about Volusia County, which is Daytona Beach, traditionally manufacturing hub of Florida, blue collar, labor, you know, fairly Democratic. Obama won it by, you know, some reasonable margin in 08, kind of started to slip a little bit away from us in 12, like a lot of communities that have working class whites. By 16, I mean, we went from, you know, winning it by 15,000 votes in 2008 to losing it by 33,000 votes in 2016. Or a place like Pasco County, which is a sort of ex-urban big county just north of Tampa, was a place that Obama lost by 8,000 the first time, 13,000 the second time, and Clinton lost by 53,000 votes. And so, you know, I think, you know, it's places like that where the election really turned. And, you know, if you're Joe Biden, you know, A, you have to replicate what Secretary Clinton and Barack Obama did in the base counties, but it is a function of sort of peeling back some of that vote a little bit in those ex-urban communities, which frankly have a lot of retirees from the upper Midwest, which is why I think he's doing a little better here in a lot of those counties.
And so, and are some of the voters you're talking about, because I know we've had a focus on this in Bridge, the Obama-Trump voters,
yeah,
in some of these areas, and do you know of any movement there with that particular cohort?
Yeah, I think a lot of them are. In fact, you know, we did, you know, one of the first things we did together jointly was, you know, kind of a bigger survey, which included Florida, of these Obama-Trump voters in the suburban and ex-urban counties. And I mean, and again, I think if you think about, you know, if you think, I sort of describe, Florida is not really a place per se. Like, you know, Texas is a place and Pennsylvania is a place. Florida is just kind of this geographic mismatch of people. And it tends to politically be reflective of where people come from. And so, you know, if you're, you know, if you live in southeast Florida and Broward County, decent chance you retired from Brooklyn, you're probably, you know, pretty liberal, pretty Democratic. If you live in the I-4 corridor and you're particularly if you're white, you're probably a migrant from the upper Midwestern states. And so, you know, I remember on election night, one of the things that I was in 16 that was freaking me out was these communities that have a lot of retirees from places like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan were just going apeshit for Trump. And, you know, and so I sort of worried it was going to, what happened. But the same way, Brett, I mean, a lot of the voters you all have been very focused on that we're seeing real movement on, thanks to y'all's work in those upper Midwestern states, this, again, the retired versions of them are living in Florida. And so I think you're seeing some of that same movement that you all are seeing with your cohort of voters in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania that you all have been working on for a year now, doing really, really impressive work. And, you know, we're seeing those same, basically the retired versions of those people responding in the same way to the stuff that you all are doing up in the Midwest.
Talk a little bit about the Latino vote. There have been some polls that suggest that Biden's having a little trouble there. It's obviously not a monolithic electorate that we're talking about, so it's complicated. What do you think about the prospects there and what needs to be done?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that, you know, again, keep your point about the Latino, just the diversity in Florida is often sort of missed. If you think about a Latino voter in Nevada, you know, probably 9 out of 10 times that they're somebody who's moved there from, they have Mexican heritage. You know, in Florida, actually, most of our Latino voters self-identify as Hispanic because they actually they trace their ancestry more back to Europe or into the Caribbean. That's sort of piece one of it. You know, about a third of our Hispanic or Latino vote is Cuban. Almost a third of it is Puerto Rican, which is changing rapidly because, you know, unlike every other kind of a migrant or immigrant, like they can vote on day one because they're citizens. And so when somebody moves here from San Juan, they're registered to vote and they can vote in 28 days. And then a third of it is sort of a mix of both Central America and Latin America, depending upon where you are. So in South Florida, your non-Cuban Hispanic tends to be more, you know, Guatemalan, Nicaraguan, Venezuelan, Colombian, et cetera. If you're in, say, the Tampa Bay area, your non-Cuban Hispanic is almost entirely Mexican. So it's just an interesting challenge. I think there's 12 or 13 nations of origin that have at least 1% of the Hispanic vote in Florida. So it's just it's part of what makes it fun as a hack. Part of it, I think, frankly, credit to Secretary Clinton and President Clinton. You know, President Clinton was one of the first Democrats to aggressively go after the Cuban vote 30 years ago. And, you know, the Clintons had built remarkably good relationships in those communities. And I think she was able to do, a level of support among Cubans that I don't know is realistic for Democrats going forward. And I think some of that, again, was just, 30 years of relationships there. So I think that the Clinton number is incredibly aspirational. I also don't think that because Joe Biden's doing better with white voters that we need to get the same level to win. So I think that like Obama 2012, he won about 60-61% of the Hispanic vote is an achievable number. Trump obviously has leaned in pretty hard on some of the socialism things. He's had 4 years to really work that community. While he's done a lot of things wrong, he's done a lot of things right in terms of outreach there. I do think there's a pretty decent chance that the polls are under, in the same way as people worry about polls overrepresenting Democratic support among whites, I think there's a decent chance that they could be underrepresenting Democratic support among Hispanics. They typically do a little bit. I remember in 2012, there was a poll that everybody freaked out about that had Obama only winning Hispanics by 8 points statewide 2 weeks to go, and we won it by 22. I think you're seeing, a lot of organizations, for example, the Bloomberg people have put a significant amount of money into advertising there. The campaign has there. And so, and it's interesting is not to ramble, but what's interesting is, the issues in those communities, people kind of say like, well, I don't understand why Trump's, approach to immigration. Why aren't people freaking out? Well, keep in mind that most Hispanics in Florida came here with status. They're either a citizen because they're Puerto Rican. They had specific status because they were Cuban, and a lot of them were refugees from other places. And so while immigration, I don't want to say is unimportant, it is culturally very concerned about it, but like it's not the same driving issue you get in a place like Nevada or Texas. But what is a big issue here is things like healthcare. The Affordable Care Act is very popular even among Cubans. The president's response to the virus, education opportunities, the economy. And so I think that's where there's still real room to grow. And just one last point on it is it's also where the most actual undecided still remains. And this is very typical this time of year. Again, we just did a survey right before the Bloomberg investment, UTC did, And it was interesting, like statewide, I think we had undecided at 4 or 5%. Among non-Cuban Hispanics, it was 13%. And then like another 13% of the voters who were either with Biden or Trump were soft. And so I think there's, you know, I think there's still real opportunities there for them to continue to grow their support level there.
So you mentioned Bloomberg. What's the impact of the Bloomberg spending in Florida, do you think?
Well, I think it's been significant in two, I think there's two sort of independent things. I mean, first of all, obviously just the throw weight on TV and digital is important. I think that they are also investing in a significant way in, you know, in organizations that are doing really good work on the ground. And they, I mean, I think one of the, you know, of the investments they made, they've I think as they publicly announced, they've invested millions in a lot of these organizations, you know, Florida New Majority, Somos, Unite Here, which is doing really good union organizing, you know, that have been doing sort of relationship type organizing, voter registration at the doors in communities. And they've invested in those communities, invested in those organizations, which I think is great. Because I do think that, and I totally understand why the campaign has made the decisions they've made around in-person campaigning and things like that. As you know, in a lot of these urban communities, campaigning is sort of hand-to-hand combat. And so I think that those investments are really important. But I think in some ways, like one of the bigger stories that's not really written about the Bloomberg investment is, you know, win or lose. And I get it. I think we have a great shot at winning Florida. But winning or losing Florida, what they've done is they've forced the campaign sort of into the land war in Asia in Florida, the Trump campaign. And you see it every day in their competitives that they've, you know, they've pulled out of Ohio. They've cut down their TV in Iowa. They've reduced their buys in the upper Midwestern states because they know they have to win Florida. I mean, it doesn't matter if they win. I mean, the last president to go to the White House, the Republican president without Florida was Calvin Coolidge. And so, you know, like if they don't win Florida and Ohio, this thing is cooked. And so I do think that Trump, just the throw weight of their spend in Florida has forced the Trump people to, you know, they're clearly having money issues to refocus their finances. It's like in the end, like even if we were to lose Florida, I think it clears the path in a lot of ways for, you know, for them to go win, for us collectively to go win in a bunch of other places. I know probably like you guys, just, you know, we've sort of made the decision on putting my UTC hat on that, you know, we don't really need to go spend in Florida in a really big way because we can now go all focus on the stuff that we've been doing for the last 6 months. And so I think that's sort of the other piece of this investment that often doesn't get talked about is it really has freed up the both the campaign and the external efforts to go, you know, to go run up, hopefully run up the score elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. One more question on Florida, and then I want to move on. But what about the ex-felon vote? What's going on with that? You know, there was a referendum, and then we had the poll tax put in. We know that Bloomberg's offering to pay some of these fines. What's the status of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, just, you know, for your listeners, Florida was one of two or three states that did not have automatic restoration of rights for ex-felons who, once they had, you know, sort of paid their debt to society, were able to vote again. Back in 2008 or 7 or 8, former Governor Charlie Crist actually, through executive action, created a pathway to back to sort of normal citizenship and voting and getting your franchise back and all of that. Rick Scott, when he became, that led to about 200,000, I think it was, ex-felons rejoining the voting rolls. Governor Scott rescinded that completely, back to where if you want to get your rights restored, you literally as an ex-felon had to go before the governor and clemency board, which is the cabinet, and basically beg for your rights. And, you know, I think it's like 40 or 50 people a year were successful at doing that. And so in 2018, the voters of Florida adopted a constitutional amendment, overwhelmingly bipartisan. Like, it was one of the better moments of Florida voters history. It was like 65-35 that ex-felons, you know, could vote again. That ended up in the courts. What does paying your debt to society mean? The Supreme Court has ruled that means that you have to pay any debts, any fines, those kind of things. Is part, in addition to whatever time you had to serve. Part of the challenge with that, honestly, is, like, you know, people that had minor felonies 40, 50 years ago, a lot of times I don't even know what those fines were. They were written down on index cards. I mean, so there's actually some issues there. So, but that's the current law. So there were a number of voters who registered to vote fairly quickly upon the amendment passing, because when the amendment passed, the local supervisors made the decision that they should open up the floodgates and let people register. What happened is there are now voters who have fines that they are aware of, but are also registered to vote, if that makes sense. And so I think what the, you know, the Bloomberg contribution, as well as a number of other folks who contributed to the fund, the goal was to pay off, I think it was 30 or 40,000 people who had registered to vote, but who may have a flag because there's not a fine paid. There's some question about people that registered before the Supreme Court ruled that you had to pay your fine. So that's that piece. But none of this is going to impact the, you know, 800,000 or 900,000 ex-felons who are still now in limbo, which we're going to have to deal with after the election. So I will say this. I think one of the things that often people think about when they think of ex-felons, that people assume that must mean minorities and Democrats. It really doesn't. I mean, the felon population, ex-felon population in Florida looks just like Florida. I mean, it's diverse politically, ideologically, in every way. And so I don't think that, you know, some people who think this somehow is a panacea politically, it's really not. It's the right thing to do. And that's the only thing that really is important. But like, even if all 900,000 ended up on the rolls, it's not like it was going to have a huge political benefit one way or the other. Because, you know, again, the external population looks just like Florida.
Right, right. So it's something of a wash, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about Unite, why you got involved, started it in October, I believe, of 2019. So you were early in for Biden. So what got you involved and why were you early in for Biden?
Well, so David is, you know, we've all been doing this for a while. I mean, I like all of us, you know, I sort of drew my affinity to Joe Biden just from personal experience. I mean, I've joked before, you know, my first ever experience with Joe Biden was not a good one. It was nothing that he did. I was a pup staffer for the Florida Democratic Party in the early 2000s, maybe even in the late 90s. So long ago, I can't remember. And he had come to our Democratic convention. And actually, I think President Clinton also came in Florida. And one of my jobs was to help keep the thing on schedule. And the combination of, you can imagine, the two of those guys blew up my entire schedule. And I was just like, you know, and that meant all of my friends who were going to speak as young Democrats and like my boss in the legislature didn't get to speak. And so I was very angry at Joe Biden for that, which was a ridiculous reason to be angry with him. But, you know, at 24, that was important to me. And so when he got picked as vice president, I still kind of harbored this little like thing from, you know, like the late 90s. And I didn't staff when the principals would come to Florida. I honestly was the CEO of a company of 600 employees and $70 million budget. I didn't really go out and staff the principals that often when they were here, unless I just had to. And so we had Joe Biden came to Tampa, Florida for his first, I think it was first or second event in Florida as VP nominee. For whatever reason, I ended up having to go staff him that day. On top of that, I had my nephew who was 13 years old that day with me, who did not want to go to a Joe Biden rally any more than I wanted to go to a Joe Biden rally. And we go to this thing. And, you know, what I remember, like sort of Biden walks in the back door, and, you know, you've been backstage, we're standing there kind of waiting to tell him where to go. And he's got the aviators on and everything. And he immediately ignored like the mayor. He ignored like three or four donors. He ignored me. And he went right up to my nephew, put him in a headlock, gave him a, you know, a thing on the head, and was like, "Man, why aren't you in school? Like, what are you doing?" And just, you know, it just had this very human moment with my nephew for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, who still talks about it. I mean, Connor turned 25 yesterday, still talks about it. And I just remember like sort of seeing, you know, and David, as you guys like us, we've been blessed to get to see these people, you know, away from the camera. And I had a chance to spend enough time around Joe Biden in both 08 and 12 and during the administration to really see that he was just a different kind of person. You know, I can't imagine just knowing him how much this quarantine has to drive him crazy, because this is a guy that lives for human interaction. I mean, he's maybe is, you know, Bill Clinton was probably the greatest ever. Joe Biden's not far behind when it comes to being, you know, a retail politician. And, I had committed to him. I'd committed to everyone that I was in if he was in, and, you know, did that dance for 2 or 3 years. And long and short of it, I actually sort of in my mind had planned to go to the campaign. I figured, you know, at some point I'd probably go to Philadelphia, and at some point they'd probably send me to Florida. It's kind of what I thought. And, if you remember back in October, it was President Trump had announced that they were going to spend $10 million in negative ads against Joe Biden in the early primary states. They were going to try to essentially kind of disqualify him early. And, you know, I think that a group of us realized that, you know, we just somebody needed to go stand something up to make sure that he just wasn't completely swamped. For the combination of that with the fact that, you know, he was also running against some people that were able to raise significant more. So just that was kind of what led to it. At the time, it was sort of the highest and best use. I never in my life set out to start a super PAC, and I'll probably be one and done when this is over. But it's been an interesting ride.
So tell the listeners a little bit, what's involved with running a super PAC? What's the Unite program? What are some of the messages that work best for Biden?
Yeah, you know, so when we got in the primary, you know, one of the things that we said, and one of the things that the vice president actually made very clear publicly, or his campaign did, we never got into this thing to try to tear down other Democrats. I mean, you know, I mean, I had talked to several campaigns, you know, prior to my guy getting in, and I'd committed to several that, if they were the nominee, we were all in. So, we never sort of set out to go in and, you know, throw fire on other candidates. We went in to try to sort of help just tell a little bit of the Biden story. And, our work in the primary was largely, you know, I use the word foundational, like, you know, we're trying to go in and make sure people understood sort of the story, that people understood the record he'd done, and, you know, during the Obama administration before. And what was interesting, like, and we saw this in both the primary and the general. Early in the general, is, you know, people they know who Joe Biden was. They knew he was Barack Obama's running mate. They might have sort of heard a little bit about Bo's story. They knew he'd been around a long time, but they really couldn't define the things about him that they thought they kind of liked about him. And so, and what was interesting was, you know, particularly like in the primary, you know, one of the challenges was, you know, guys went through this in 16, like. You have a candidate running against people who are sort of admittedly very progressive, though your candidate is actually pretty progressive too. So, like, you know, we had to go in and kind of talk through some of the work that he'd done on the climate early on in his career, the Balance Against Women Act, and that kind of work. And what was interesting is I think like a lot of people thought that the primary was going to go on a lot longer. There were days where I wasn't sure the primary was going to go on very long at all. But like once we got through South Carolina, I remember the night of the Nevada caucuses. I was at a friend's. I went over to a friend's backyard and we built a bonfire because I couldn't be in front of my TV. I was like we're either going to be the nominee tonight. We're going to finish second and we're going to go to South Carolina and we're going to be the nominee, or we're not. And I'm gonna have to go pack up bags. What was interesting, and I think I don't want to talk about our partnership, but I think it has been really vital to us. You know, we thought the race was going to go longer in the primary. The primary came to an end pretty quickly. You know, we had spent our entire time thinking about how to elect Joe Biden. We had spent no time thinking about how to beat Trump. That was just not our mission. And what was interesting, so, you know, when Bradley from your team and I started talking, the thing that you all brought to the table for us that was completely, invaluable, is you all had spent 2 years thinking about the best way to go at Trump and to do that by, you know, real people telling their stories and sort of the permission structure idea behind everything, you know, that the PAC side is doing there. And that research that we were able to benefit from, the work that you all had done, allowed us to kind of end up going a little different direction, which was, you know, We found that honestly, like our highest and best use in the ecosystem of super PACs doing work was to kind of keep doing the work that we were doing, you know, and what we found when we were talking to voters was in a lot of these states, you know, particularly suburban women, some older voters, you know, et cetera, they'd kind of made a decision, as you all know, that they really didn't want to vote for Trump again. But they weren't really sure why they would vote for Joe Biden. And so, you know, we were able to go in and really kind of lay out some of the economic message, some of the COVID stuff. And again, I think the work that you all have done and we've done, I mean, I'm super proud of it. You know, I think that, you know, it's, you know, and this is not meant to be a shot at anything, but like, it's super easy to go make a fun viral anti-Trump ad. Like, you know, anybody can do that, you know, but like, you know, the work that, you know, the ads that you all do, the ads that we've done that are really sort of build that foundation of A, just like why real people are disqualifying Trump, B, why Joe Biden should be president. I think it's, you know, it's been really vital work, particularly early, you know, and so, yeah, but that's kind of who we are. We're not very big. You know, we're probably going to go away in 26 days, but it's been a hell of a ride.
Sounds that way. Well, thanks a lot for joining us today, Steve. I appreciate it.
And David, I really enjoyed it. It's good talking to you.
Great. Thanks very much for doing this. Steve, this has been a great conversation. Thanks so much for joining us today and keeping the good fight until Election Day. For more information on American Bridge, please visit AmericanBridgePAC.org. Check back for more podcasts and information about the upcoming election and how we plan to hold Republicans accountable. Until next time, I'm David Brock. Thanks for listening to The War Room at American Bridge.